Time is 3:05 and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. With the forecast for tonight, mostly cloudy skies with isolated rain showers later on, low temperatures around 36 degrees, southeast winds to 10 miles per hour. Forecast for Saturday, cloudy skies with scattered rain showers, high temperatures around 56 degrees. Tomorrow marks the anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic. In observance of that moment in American and world history, Pat Moore produced the following piece.
100 years ago tomorrow night, the radio operator aboard the Europe-bound SS Carpathia recorded a distress call which would shake the world. Minutes before, the SS Titanic, steaming through a clear, moonless night at 21.5 knots, had plowed into an iceberg, ripping a huge gash in the 800-foot-long vessel's hull and flooding its engine room. The Carpathia's radio log records the following message, received at 11:20 p.m., New York time. Struck iceberg. Come to our assistance at once. Position latitude 4146 north, longitude 5014 west. The log records that the Carpathia's operator, Harold Cottam, informed his master at once. The message was almost not intercepted at all. In 1912, many ships did not have radio equipment on board. Aboard those with radio gear, operators shut their systems down at night. This was the case with the SS California, only 20 miles from the Titanic. Cyril Evans, the radio operator aboard the California, had shut down and gone to bed hours earlier. Technically, the Carpathia's radio operator was also off watch. But Cottam had decided to come in for one last listen before going to bed, when he copied the Titanic's SOS. At the time, 58 miles separated the two ships. The Titanic operators were almost unable to send the message. Senior operator Jack Phillips and junior operator Harold Bride had spent almost all day the 14th repairing the ship's 5,000-watt rotary spark gap transmitter. They had only brought the transmitter back online a few hours before the collision. Upon receipt of the Titanic's transmission, the Carpathia's master swung her about and headed for the stricken vessel. His crew heroically coaxed the slower ship to 17 knots. She usually only made 13 or 14. On the way, radio operator Cottam recorded this last log entry from the Titanic, whose call sign was MGY, at 12:28 p.m. SOS, SOS, CQD, CQD, from MGY. We are sinking fast, passengers being put into boats. MGY. The Carpathia made it to the accident scene by daybreak, hours after the sinking, but still in time to save 712 of the Titanic's 2,223 passengers who had made it away in boats. Among them, the junior radio operator, Harold Bride. Jack Phillips, the senior operator, had succumbed to exposure, as had many other passengers and crewmen waiting in lifeboats in the cold North Atlantic. Bride, despite frozen feet, manned the Carpathia's radio alongside Cottam, until the vessel docked in New York, transmitting message after message to families and loved ones. Bright eventually left the sea, married, became a civil engineer, died in 1984 at the age of 93. He, Jack Phillips, and Cottam are true heroes. The disaster touched off a firestorm of international investigations, which eventually led to the passage of laws requiring radios aboard almost all vessels to be staffed 24/7 by at least two operators. The law required that all coastal and shipboard radio stations in the maritime service stop transmissions every 15 minutes and listen on 500 kilohertz, the same frequency the Titanic had transmitted on, for 3 minutes to intercept any distress call. The radio watch continued on 500 kilohertz until modern digital and satellite communication was deemed to have made it obsolete. The era ended August 1, 1999, with a last exchange between a Canadian coastal station, VCO, and a Cuban fishing vessel. Two of us, here in the studio, have stood radio watches aboard ships at sea as part of that era. My guest, Sam Binkley, and myself. Sam, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Tell us a bit, if you would, Sam, about being a Sparks. You served with the Coast Guard, right? They called them Sparks because of the first spark transmitters, but of course none of us ran those. Neither of us did.
Yeah, that's why we were referred to as Sparks. And yes, I had a 23-year career in the Coast Guard, And all of that time was during the era when we used Morse code to pass most of the traffic that we handled.
Now, that Morse code that you did it on several different frequencies, several different radio frequencies, but the primary watch was on 500. Why was that frequency chosen, do you know?
The propagation at those frequencies lended itself well to the daytime range in the order of 250, 300 miles, and then at night 3 or 4,000 miles is not all that uncommon.
Sam, when you were standing the radio watch, were you the only radio operator on board the vessel, or were there others?
I was on three different ships. On two of those, we only had three operators, and so there was only one of us to listen at any given time. And we always guarded the 500 kilohertz frequency along with our Coast Guard working frequencies that we guarded.
There was actually a clock, I remember. I worked on the motor vessel Testamina with the ferry service. I was the second operator on there for a year. And I remember there was a clock that was especially marked at 15-minute intervals. You had a red, our clock had a red arc on it that you weren't to transmit during.
That's correct. The silent periods were actually from 15 to 18 and 45 to 48.
And
it was twice per hour that those 3-minute silent periods is what we call them, and nobody in the world was supposed to be transmitting during that time except a vessel in distress, and that was so that any weak station that might be in distress could be heard.
Now, the signal SOS has a very specific meaning, and it kind of strikes fear and terror into the hearts of a radio operator to hear it, because you know that that means someone's in trouble. We have a recording of you were able to provide me with a recording that a friend of yours had been involved in, where he was actually one of the operators, I think, involved when this ship sent an SOS?
Yes, the motor ship Prince and Dom.
Yeah. So, Sam, what's he saying?
He's sending SOS and his call sign. Okay. PJTA is the Prince and Dom's call sign.
And then what else will he normally send as part of the message?
The first thing he'll probably send is his position and then the nature of his distress and what assistance he is going to require.
Now, the Prince and Dam, I think, had flooded engine rooms. I believe the operator sends something like that in this message. And then it actually sank. She went down, but they got everyone off of the ship, I think.
Yes, that's correct.
Right.
And we can thank good radio communications for that successful rescue.
Now, the second signal is now in behind there. Okay, at this point he's sending his location in latitude and longitude numbers and like that.
Yes.
Okay, and then he'll go on to describe more detail about the actual situation that he's in. And then at the after a bit, another station comes in and I think volunteers to take over command of the frequency so that the Prince and Dam doesn't have to try to control the following transmission.
Yes, I think that's correct.
Yeah. He's saying that the engine room is flooded there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. So when you were, did you ever hear an SOS when you were?
Yes, I've heard several of them and been involved in direct communications with a few.
Uh-huh. And normally, though, the 500 was also used in those periods between the watch intervals, the three-minute sections, was used as a normal frequency for passing ship's traffic and so weather observations and things like that.
It was used as a calling frequency, and once the communications was established, then the ship and coastal station would switch to their working frequencies.
So you would hear lots of stations calling CQ, asking for someone to take them off frequency and take their traffic and like that. Here's a sample of what it sounds like in Europe, or sounded like in Europe, when 500 was watched on a daily basis. Sam and I are smiling here because of that terrific chirp on that one guy's signal. That happens because of the power supply of the radio probably not giving him quite enough energy to keep his signal level and true like the guy that's in the front of the transmission. Anyway, so this cacophony was what you heard on a daily basis, and you kind of had to sort that out. Okay, none of this is emergency traffic. This is just routine traffic on 500, and
that's a coastal station in Spain sending a CQ telling the world that he has traffic for certain vessels.
It's, geez, that's like music to me. Probably not to some of our listeners. It's probably a little bit a strange sound to hear. 500 died, well, the CW code aboard vessels died in 1999. And some of the messages that were sent by the last operators from the coastal stations out to the ships have a rare poignancy to them. It was guys saying goodbye to each other who had been in contact with each other for years. Did you have friends that you made over the radio?
Oh, yes. Had several friends that I made. You would recognize a fist and the sound of the transmitter right away.
Yeah. Most of this was sent with a hand type of key. Usually, I think most of the shipboard operators either used a pump handle, a straight up and down code key, or a sideways key like a bug. And because of it's not electronically generated, you have a fist. Your code has a unique sound to it. And people recognize you by the way you make the dots and dashes.
Very distinctive sound to most anyone's fist.
Yeah. Well, Sam, we've shared a lot of memories here. It's a shame, I think, in many ways that the code died aboard the ships. One of the operators in Canada, or actually in England, sent a message that in 1998 when they closed down the last coastal station in England, in which he said, basically, he was referring to the new system that was going to come up. He said, I hope it's as good as this has been. And the other guy said, well, good luck. Anyway, so that was the end of the era. Sometimes I feel like a dinosaur, knowing code as well as I do and being able to speak that other language. Do you have the same feeling?
Oh, yes, and I try to use it every day on the amateur bands.
Yeah, I should mention that both Sam and I are amateur radio operators and continue to use our Morse code to communicate with other people around the world who also use Morse code and enjoy it very much. So it's not a totally dead art, although it is dead in the sense of being the way ships communicate with shoreside stations. Sam, thanks for helping us remember the Titanic and telling us a little bit about being a shipboard radio operator.
My pleasure.
Thanks to Pat Moore for producing that segment on the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 13th of April, 2012. The birthday of Thomas Jefferson, born Albemarle County, Virginia, 1743, primary author of the Declaration of Independence, who also wrote books on farming and gardening, and whose personal library was the largest private collection in this country, 6,487 volumes. He sold it to Congress after the British burned down the Library of Congress. It's the birthday of Samuel Beckett, born in Fox Rock, a suburb of Dublin, 1906. Studied French literature in college, then went to Paris, where he met James Joyce, who by that time was almost blind and working on Finnegan's Wake. Beckett became his assistant. He read books to Joyce. He took dictation. He walked with him around Paris. He idolized Joyce so much that he began to smoke like Joyce and walk like Joyce. And he tried to write in Joyce's meandering style, but Beckett said, I realized that my own way was in taking away, in subtracting, rather than in adding. 1952, Samuel Beckett wrote his play Waiting for Godot, with its repeated motif, I can't go on, I will go on, in which Estragon says, I can't go on like this, and Vladimir says, that's what you think. Samuel Beckett, who wrote, My mistakes are my life. Where I am, I don't know, I'll never know. In the silence, you don't know, you must go on. Try again, fail better. He wrote, We are all born mad, some remain so. Dance first, think later, it's the natural order. And Samuel Beckett said, Nothing is funnier than unhappiness. And it's the birthday of Eudora Welty, born Jackson, Mississippi, 1909, who wrote several novels, including The Optimist's Daughter, but she's best known for her short stories, which she wrote and rewrote, cutting them apart at her dining room table. You can tour her house and garden in Jackson for $5, the house at 1119 Pinehurst Street. She moved into the house in 1925 with her parents when she was 16, and she lived there until she died in 2001. The garden has been restored, too. It was planted by her mother, Chestina, so that there would be something in bloom all year round. Larkspur, hollyhocks, and snapdragons in the spring, phlox, zinnias, and blue salvia in the summer, asters, chrysanthemums, and spider lilies in the fall, and camellias and pansies in the winter, and climbing roses on trellises. Here's a poem for today by Faith Sheeran, entitled Storage. That year we left the house we couldn't afford and put our belongings in storage. We were free now to travel or live in tiny spaces. We kept our chairs and tables in a cement cell, our bookshelves, our daughter's old toys, clothes we wouldn't wear or discard. There were books we liked but did not need, and mattresses and pots and pans. Sometimes we went to visit our things, sat in our rocking chairs, searched for a jacket, listened to an old radio. It was like visiting someone I loved in a hospital, the way, removed from the world, a person or object becomes thin, diminished. The furniture on which we lived our young life had no job but to wait for us. It remembered our dinners, the light through our windows, the way the baby once played on the floor. Storage by Faith Sheeran, from Moving the Piano, published by Stephen F. Austin State University Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, iPad users can download the three most recent issues of Poetry Magazine, celebrating its centennial in 2012, at poetryfoundation.org. Written by Heather McPherson, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Every day I see how rape and sexual abuse change the lives of Alaskans.
Victims can be male or female, young or old, but their pain is the same.
If you're a victim of sexual assault, don't stay silent. There is help and there is hope.
Call your local shelter or your 24-hour crisis line. Asking for help changes everything.
Together, we can stop violence and abuse. Real Alaskans choose respect.
Visit andvsa.org or call 1-800-799-SAFE.
Time is 3:25 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guest is Folk Festival dance caller, the guest dance caller for the 38th Annual Alaska Folk Festival, Tony Mates. Tony, thank you for coming down to the station today.
Thank you, Jeff.
So first of all, a big question, what's the difference between a square and a contra?
Square dance and a contra dance. Well, from sufficient distance, they would probably appear identical. If you were from Mars, you might just say, oh, it's just people moving around with each other to music. And I remember the first contra dance I ever danced, and I was pretty confused because I think I knew what a square dance was shaped like, and this was shaped kind of different, and I couldn't make it out. But basically, square dancing comes more from the southern tradition in the U.S., and contra dancing derives from New England dance forms, though it's now popular all over the country and all over the world. The music that comes with them reflect the geographic background of their sources, so southern square dance music is more like hoedowns, and New England contra dance music is maybe a little bit more formal, a little bit more complicated in some ways, but they're both really accessible folk dance forms, and there are differences obviously between them, but they're awful similar in a lot of ways too. You dance with a partner, you execute certain figures. Big difference in a contra dance is you're in long lines of actually any length, and you have a partner and you dance with a couple, and then you progress on to another couple and dance with them. So you can dance with 100 people in the course of a dance, whereas a square, by definition, is a smaller group, typically 8 people who do a figure all together in a sort of closed environment. So they're different, and people have different tastes, but I like them both.
You're a musician as well as a caller. Which came first, the music or the calling?
Which came first? Well, for me, it would have to be the music. I began playing old-time fiddle music back in the late 70s, and there was a few players in Seattle where I lived, and then there was actually a band called the Gypsy Gypo String Band, and they had a weekly square dance at a place called the Gino Tavern, and I really loved the music, and I just wanted to go and hear these guys play, so I would go to the dance, and I would stand up there by the stage and watch them play. And well, if you've been to a dance, you're reasonably well put together, and you're standing and moving around to the music, pretty soon some girl will ask you to dance, as it happens. And so the people who were dancing were also friends of mine who played music, and it was kind of a nice community of folks. And I wasn't terribly interested in dancing, but these nice people asked me, and so I said, okay. So I started dancing, and this was to the calling of Sandy Bradley, who was hugely influential on callers all over the country. But I started going to dances every week for 2 or 3 years to hear the music and to dance, because I found I enjoyed the dancing. And so after a couple years of this, I had pretty much a collection of dances in my head. I'd never called any, but it was all sort of there in the background, ready to be activated when necessary. But the music came first.
What are the top 5 rules for a successful caller?
Top 5 rules for a successful caller. Boy, show up on time. Actually, get there early would be good. Maintain a good attitude. Sometimes it seems like work, but it's really about having fun with other people. So you want to make sure that's why you're there, and you can get caught up in your agendas of what you're trying to do, but it really is all about having fun with music and the people. So that's 2. Communicate with the band. So that you're really working with them. You're sort of a conduit. You've got dancers in front of you and music behind you, and it's supposed to come through you, or at least the dance information's coming from you. And so working with the band is real important. That's 3. Number 4, have a good sense of rhythm. A good knowledge of the music, a good sense of pitch, because you want to be part of the music as much as you can. That's 4. Keeping it simple, in a sense, But being aware of just what you can get away with, you look at a crowd and you think, well, these folks, they're pretty sophisticated dancers, and so I'm gonna have to pull out my fanciest dance and wow them with that, and then it falls flat on its face, and you go, gee, I should have just done something simple, and they would have enjoyed it. So that's, I don't know, 5.5 rules.
Sounds pretty good. You're going to be performing some couple calls during the course of the weekend of the Alaska Folk Festival. See one Saturday, the High Lonesome Sound with caller Tony Mason from Anchorage, Alaska, the Dusty Rider, Amanda Kerr, Graham Volper, Carter Bancroft, and Eric Rogers. Do you know what else on your schedule?
Well, we have, yes. I'll be calling with two bands Saturday night. And then I'm doing two workshops. I think one is Saturday and one is Sunday during the day. And the one on Saturday will be square dancing. And it'll just be a workshop devoted to square dancing. And then I think on Sunday, I'm doing a workshop on how to call dances, contra dances or square dances, for people who are interested in doing that, just kind of getting your feet wet a little bit.
Those are happening Saturday night with the performances, and then during the weekend on Saturday and Sunday there are free workshops. In fact, the whole festival is free to the open to the public. Do you have a secret for sizing up an audience?
I like to get to a dance early. There are certain dances that are kind of known quantities, weekly dances that I might be a part of in Seattle or other places where the people who come there are kind of dedicated dancers, and the skill level is pretty high. And then there's other dances sometimes where I do a lot of private parties, weddings, birthday parties, and so on, where, you know, people are just there to have a good time, and they may not know very much about the dancing. And so you have to kind of calibrate and think about, okay, what can I do that gets people moving to the music as quickly as possible. And so, yeah, you have to understand the situation you're getting into. And it can fool you. I was at a dance in Lopez Island in the San Juans, and everything was going fine, and then I got distracted by something happening backstage, and I came back to call another dance, and I was doing a dance. I thought, this one's pretty easy. And it turned out that people weren't getting it, and I couldn't understand why, because everything had been going so well. Well, it turns out about 20 young kids had come in at 11 o'clock, and they had not been at the dance at all, and they didn't, you know, they hadn't picked up any of the skills that you could have gotten in that time, but I hadn't seen it, so they fooled me. But keeping an eye on the floor and just seeing who's there and seeing how they move, actually, you can kind of tell dancers by how they get themselves set up to dance and how they interact with their partner and so on. So a lot of it's just history, just keeping my eyes open.
I've been talking with Tony Mates, the Folk Festival dance caller for the 30th Annual Alaska Folk Festival. He'll be doing a couple of callings on Saturday night, one at 10, 8 to 10 to 9 o'clock, another one 9:20 to 10:10. Tony, thank you very much, and also a couple of workshops during the course of the weekend, and you can get this information by going online at folkfestival.org, or just come on down to the Folk Festival and get a copy of the program. Tony, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Thank you, Jeff. You're welcome.
Other special events going on at the Alaska Folk Festival include the Radfish Wranglers with Ray Troll. It's Saturday night at 6 o'clock. Here's a sample of Ray's music now.
I was a small fry, all I wanted to do is get in the stream and swim right up to you. I want your love, baby, I want your love. I got a one-way ticket right on up to your shore now. Love you, baby, please don't lock that door. It's my biology, it's in my genes.
Some people say there's lots of fish in the sea. I think they're right, cause there's one there for me. Don't slip away, honey.
Oh, don't cut that line.
One of these days I'm
throw me a snout for a humpback baby and check things out. That's my destiny, sugar. My fate to be.
Oh, yes, well, I say.
Oh, baby, spawn, spawn, spawn till you die, baby. Spawn, spawn, spawn till you die.
Turns me on. I want to spill my milk until the break of dawn. Let's have some fun, darling, all night long. And when you flip your fins and you shake your little tail, when you dig that bed, I sure hope my engine don't fail. Don't let it down, baby. Don't swim away.
Yeah, I'd swim 100 miles. I always love to travel. I'd go 1,000 more if I could get you in the gravel. My love is strong,
oh,
baby.
Yeah, baby.
You know you are. When my number is up and it's time to meet my maker, I'll be spawning up in heaven with Jim and Tammy Baker.
Amen.
Up in the sky.
Lord, yeah.
Yeah.
Tool and the Redfish Wranglers will be appearing in a special event free at the Juno Arts and Culture Center at 6 o'clock on Saturday night. On the phone with her now is author Mary Albanese. She'll be in town on Sunday doing a presentation and book signing from 1 to 3 of the Horsehead Books in the Valley. Mary, author of Midnight Sun, Arctic Moon, thank you for being on the show with me today.
Thank you for having me. This is great.
So this is put out by Epicenter Press, and you're in Ketchikan now signing copies of the books there.
Yeah, I just had a book signing last night, and I'm flying up today to Juneau.
A little bit about your background, please.
I lived in New York, and I wanted to be a teacher, a school teacher for science, and I applied to every school district in the state of Alaska, and this was back in 1977, and at the time I didn't get a single job, so I came up anyway and ended up being a geologic explorer, which was a lot harder. So the message of the book is, if at first you don't succeed, try something that's harder.
The book chronicles the Alaskan adventures of what could have been a not as exciting life as a science teacher. Could you describe the path you went on and how a chance comment led to a detour?
Yeah, sometimes life does that. You know, you think you're heading down one path and you get a curveball, and I was disappointed at first, and I ended up doing something that was a lot more exciting, a lot more difficult, but a lot more... Well, for me, it ended up being a lot more rewarding.
You're a woman, and it was traditionally a man's field. Has that been difficult for you?
Yeah, it was. You know, a lot of people were pretty good, but there was, you know, some attitudes that you had to work around, or, you know, convince them by working harder than everybody else. But, you know, it can be still like that sometimes in some places for women in science. But you just keep pushing and, you know, doing your work, and finally get your recognition.
Your prologue features an encounter with a bear. What kind of book did you set out to write, and how successful do you think you were in the end?
It's been getting a lot of really great reviews from a lot of places that don't usually review books like this. So I'm pretty pleased that it's finding a market, an audience wider than Alaska. I kind of want to showcase Alaska for what it is, a place where all kinds of things are possible, and a pretty magic place for me anyway.
Can you give the listeners an idea, like an overview of the book, please?
Overview of the book. Well, I start how I went up to Fairbanks to be a teacher. A mistake, actually, led me in a different path. And it tells about what it's like to become a geologic explorer. This was back in the late 70s when a lot of the state hadn't been mapped yet. And it was a pretty exciting time because people my age, myself and my colleagues going to school, ended up mapping considerable chunks of the state. So it was pretty outrageous that some young kids like us could have such a big impact. So it tells, you don't have to be a geologist to like this book. It does tell what it was like to become an explorer, a geologic explorer, but you really don't need to know a stick of science to be carried away by the stories.
What inspired you to write, or who inspired you to write?
Well, it was kind of weird. I hadn't thought about writing it, and then there was a significant event that happened in my life, and 30 years later, to the day of that event, I just started writing and didn't stop till it was done.
Do you do a lot of rewriting, or is it pretty much straight from the first take?
The first draft took 3 months to write. The second, third, and fourth took about 4 years. But that's the writing process. Very few people actually come out with a fabulous first draft. The first draft you generally do for yourself, and then you refine it for your audience.
Where have you been traveling with the book so far?
I started in San Francisco. I started at the Booksmith, at Height and Ashbury in San Francisco, the iconic hippie generation area. And then I went up to Seattle and got to Ketchikan yesterday. And from here, after Juneau, I will be heading further north, Anchorage, Fairbanks, Talkeetna, Healy, places like that.
You lived in Juneau for a while, didn't you?
Yeah, I lived there for about 2.5 years. I taught at the University UAS there for a while. And that was another thing, another chance situation that changed my life. I went to the university office there, and I was walking around, and I found the chancellor's door. It was open. So I knocked on it and went in, and I said, "You need somebody to teach geology?" And he said, "No, but I need somebody to teach English. You want to do that?" So I ended up doing that, and I quite liked it.
Why is the study of geology important to you, and why would you inspire others to study it?
Well, I've always liked science. Science is how we find out about the world, and it's a way that somebody who's interested in the way the world works can really get their hands on exploring how it works and maybe making a contribution in discovering a little piece more of the world's knowledge.
I've been talking with author Mary Albanese, whose book Midnight Sun, Arctic Moon is published by Epicenter Press. She'll be doing a presentation on book signing this Sunday from 1 to 3 at Hearthside Books in the Valley. Mary, is there anything like that I've forgotten to ask?
I hope I see people there. I'll be happy to chat with them. It's a really good book for book groups, armchair explorers, and also teenagers. If people have got teenagers that are facing difficult situations in their life, it's kind of nice to see that you don't have to have it all planned out to end up okay. And that's kind of one of the messages of the book, too.
There's a listing of questions for book groups in the back of the book, and one of them includes, what would you bring if you had five things to bring with you on in a desolate, isolated region? What would you bring?
What would I bring? I would bring a tent, sleeping bag, food. That's pretty much the basic three.
All right. Mary Albanese, thank you for talking on radio with us today. Again, you'll be appearing in Juneau Sunday from 1 to 3 on Hearthside Books in the Valley. Thank you for being on the air with me today.
Oh, thank you for having me. Bye-bye, y'all.
Coming up next, a little bit of music from Robin Hopper. She'll be performing tonight at 9:15 at the 38th Annual Alaska Folk Festival main stage.
Well, I was toting my pack go along the glen trying to catch a ride, when along came a tour bus with 100 tourists stuffed inside. If you're going down to Anchorage with us, you can ride. So I climbed into the bus, and when I settled down inside, they asked me if I'd seen a road with so much glacier sand. And I said, listen guys, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man, breathe that mountain air. Tundra, flat and bare, man, skaters, I've had my share. Yep, here in Alaska, I've been everywhere. I've been to Anchorage, Igigig, Elmendorf, Chicknick, Turnigan, Crow Creek, North Pole, Sunder's Lake, Nikolai Glen, Highway Porter, Stretcher, Cold Bay, Peters Creek, Selawik, Wasilla, Ankenick, Cooperland, and Northway, Valdez, Seward, Icy Bay, Nancy, Lake, Chalit, and Big Lake, Kansas City. Now I've been everywhere, breathe that mountain air. Tundra, flat and bare, man, skaters, I've had my share. Yep, here in Alaska, I've been everywhere. I've been to Flattop, Icky, X, Channel, Iron, Swick, Check, Deep Creek, Collar, Flood, and Beaver, Soft, Duck, Dead Horse, Caribou, Resurrection, Igaloo, Weedy, Unicus, Kichu, Canan, the Barren Sea, Purgatory, Rainbow, Vena, Tank, Oho, Long Tongue, Bird, Fall, Sleeping Lady, Utah. I've been everywhere. Breathe that mountain air. Tundra, flat and bare, man, skaters, I've had my share. Yep, here in Alaska, I've been everywhere. I've been to Bird Bear, Antioch, Trapper, Kikichukiak, Cooper, Besidotna, Hunter Creek, Tacotna, Willow Creek, Skagway, Jewel Lake, Cannon Bay, Russian River, Kodiak, Mount Vils, Togiak, Chickaloon, Koyaka, Porcupine, Shagala, Kennecott, and Anasawa, Dokokana. I've been everywhere. Breathe that mountain air. Tundra, flat and bare, man, skaters, I've had my share. Yep, here in Alaska, I've been everywhere. I've been to Mud Bay, Cannery, Taylor, Rango, Bopasee, Tanana, Fish Creek, Glen Allen, Scatter Peak, Hawk Point, Lac, Tacanal, York, and Noatak, Bethlehem, Gullivan, Anchor Point, and Pelican, Orbit, Donald, Spence, and Waterfall, and Yetna, Sandpoint, Yorkalina, Shishmer, Cavalina. I've been everywhere. Breathe that mountain air. Tundra, flat and bare, man, skaters, I've had my share. Yap, here in Alaska, I've been everywhere. I've been to Hope, Tuna, Katsu, Catch, Cannon, Omatu, Eagle, River, Umiat, Alias, Yakutat, Girdwood, Kipnuck, Bear, Bank, Kapstock, Keynes, Keena Point, Lay, and Lux, Flesh Bay, Palmer, Chicken, Dillon, and Fruit, Bend, Tarmigan, Clear, Homer, Tokyo, Rika, Summit, Lake, Chattanooga. I've been everywhere. Breathe that mountain air. Tundra, flat and bare, man, skaters, I've had my share. Yap, here in Alaska, I've been everywhere. Yep, here in Alaska, I've been everywhere.
Is there someone in your home gifted in the art of verbal persuasion? Has Providence smiled on them and gifted them with a silver tongue that causes rational people to believe what is patently false? Then don't hide the liar in your family. Let their light shine for all to see at the second annual Liars and Fiddlers Concert at the Alaska State Museum on Saturday, the 14th of April from 1 to 3. Lie once, lie bold, and while the fiddler fiddles, let the tale be told.
Time is 3:49 and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on the Juneau Afternoon. Our next guest is Ariel Parker here to talk about Lemonade Day in Alaska, which is coming up in May, creating new entrepreneurs for Alaska one stand at a time. Ariel, thank you very much for being on the station with me today.
Thanks for having me over in the sunny day today.
So registration is tomorrow for Lemonade Day. What exactly is Lemonade Day?
Lemonade Day Alaska, in Alaska. Nationally, it's a youth program so that kids can learn business practices. They can learn how to own their own business, which is a lemonade stand. And kids of all ages can take part in Lemonade Day on May 6th. This is all of the events lead up to May 6th. So hopefully, nationally, all these kids will have their own lemonade stand open on May 6th.
Could you describe more about the program and how it works?
When kids register online, they can come into Southeast Conference office downtown in Juneau, or we can mail them. They will get a workbook after they register, and they get to go through their budget. They have to make a business plan. They have to figure out what their product is. They can learn how to open a bank account and select a site for their business, their lemonade stand.
What ages are you targeting?
Grade school up through high school. So K through 12 is the target range.
What's a lemon head?
The lemon head is it's a mascot, and somebody will wear it. And hopefully, somebody will wear it so we can get people involved in Lemonade Day. It's a great thing so that people can see what it is.
To use a bad pun, where did the idea sprout from?
Michael Holthouse actually got the idea from his daughter, wanted to start a lemonade stand, and so he said this is a great program, and we can use the lemonade stand as a model for kids to learn about business practices all over the United States.
What's the recipe for lemonade?
Whatever you want it to be. Some sunshine, some lemonade, some sugar, some lemons. Some people will do raspberries in theirs.
What's your goal this year?
Southeast area, we're going to try and put up at least 500 lemonade stands. We've already had around 300 kids register so far.
Last year you had a phenomenal number of people take part in Anchorage, is it true?
Yes, Anchorage had something like 1,100 people participate, which is fantastic. So they had a lot of participation there. So anybody can participate by buying lemonade, being a supporter, being a business supporter, or just talking about it and spreading the word.
So on Sunday, May 6th, what do you envision?
So I envision that it'll be sunny. Kids will have their lemonade stands, and everyone can participate that day on Sunday to go and buy lemonade. So the kids will have their lemonade stands. They will be serving lemonade. They'll learn how to do customer service and handle money and kind of learn things about their own business.
Do they have to be chefs or anything like that?
They don't have to be chefs. They get to make their own lemonade. There's lots of good recipes that I found in the Joy of Cooking on the Internet, and you can make up your own recipes, too.
Do you have a favorite recipe?
My favorite recipe is, about 3 cups of sugar in 2 quarts of water and some raspberry juice, too, with the lemonade, with the lemons.
Cool. If people need more information, they can come to register tomorrow, or they can call the Southeast Conference office?
Yes, the Southeast Conference office, Lemonade Day Southeast, that's 523-4353. They can call us. The address is 612 West Willoughby Avenue. It's also across the street from A&P Market near downtown.
And you're having registration tomorrow from 10 a.m. till 3 p.m. Is there a registration in Nugget Mall the next week?
Yes, the next week, the 21st, I'll have a booth there so they can register also there, too.
All right, Ariel Parker talking about Lemonade Day Alaska in Alaska coming up May 6th. If people need more information, what's that number, phone number one more time, please?
If they have any more questions, they can call 523-4353.
All right, Ariel, thank you for coming by. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Get out there on May 6th and buy some lemonade. Everybody can participate in their community. Thanks.
Shirley and Sue needed money for stuff, so they sat on the swings and they planned.
When we pool our allowance, it's never enough. Let's open a lemonade, open a lemonade stand.
They borrowed a table with one shaky leg and lemons and sugar and water. They turned on the hose and they mixed up a keg, and the price was a buck and a quarter. They sang
homemade lemonade, not from concentrate. Fresh, sweet, straight from trees, it's really, really great.
Tatiana Smolensk on her way from ballet was all plied out in her tutu. She left at the stand, did a pas de bourrée.
Tatiana, these beverages for you too.
I'm dry as a bone, can you help me?
We can!
And they poured it right into his scuba.
But I have no pocket, unfortunately.
All champions pulled up in a bus.
The last shot was either recycled.
They ordered up gallons and cheered.
Jay for us!
And they dribbled a lot as they drank it.
But we have no pockets, unfortunately.
That's okay, you can have it for free.
Homemade lemonade.
Along came a prince from his desert domain, the size of Fort Knox, only richer.
For a couple of noodles, I did up my terrain. I thought with his arm for a pitcher, and I have deep pockets as deep as the sea.
That's okay, but unfortunately, no more lemonade.
That is okay, I'll wait.
So they made more lemonade.
Thank you, this is good!
Now Shirley and Sue in their desert domain are the world's biggest lemon importer. They're rich and they're famous, they've opened a chain, and the price is a buck and a quarter. So if you should open a lemonade stand, get out to the curb bright and early. You might make lots of friends and a few hundred grand, just like our old friends Sue and Shirley.
Joe Page will be performing tonight at the 38th Annual Alaska Folk Festival on the main stage, about 10:15 or so. Broadcast of the Folk Festival happens on KRNN FM beginning at 7 o'clock, and it's 102.7 FM. Also live on the internet at krnnfm.org, actually krnn.org. Here are tuned to KTUO in Juneau. We broadcast to 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTUO also broadcasts on these translators. In Valley and Ock Bay area, tuned to K276 AF at 103.1. Lemon and Swartz Creek, K269AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201AM 88.1, K220BT Sarasuna at 91.9, and Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. You can hear KTUO on K210AS 89.9, also live online at www.ktuo.org. Coming up next Monday on a June afternoon, we'll find out about next Thursday's fly fishing workshop with guest John Lyman. Weather forecast for tonight looks like mostly cloudy skies with isolated rain showers expected. High temperature, low temperatures around 38 degrees. Forecast for Saturday, cloudy skies, scattered rain showers, high temperatures around 51 degrees. Sunday looks like mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of rain, high temperatures around 53 degrees. Coming up next, all things considered, thank you for tuning in to June afternoon today, and have a great evening, and I'll see you at the Alaska Folk Festival.
Is the victim of unbounded government appetite.
Mitt Romney in St. Louis addressing the annual meeting of the National Rifle Association. Today is Friday, April 13th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel. In this hour, Romney at the NRA and our political observers, E.J. Dionne and David Brooks, on the beginning of the real campaign for the White House. Also, Haiti tries to improve sanitation to cope with cholera.
When you make $2 a day and you have to feed your family, the last thing you think of is
sanitation.
A Massachusetts couple and their surrogate talk about the highs and lows of having a baby together.
I always thought, you know, if I...